He tore her clothes from her body and kicked her roughly down on the corpses as she struggled and tried to clutch his leg. 5 steps and he was at the top of the stairs. The yellow clothes he had wrested off were under his arm, and in a twinkling he had rushed down the steep stairs into the abyss of the night. The thunder of his descending steps pounded in the hollow tower, and then it was quiet. Shortly after that, the hag raised up her body from the corpses. Grumbling and groaning, she crawled to the top stair by the still flickering torchlight, and through the gray hair which hung over her face, she peered down to the last stair in the torchlight. Beyond this was only darkness, unknowing and unknown.
Welcome, everyone, to the Literal Fiction Book Club, where we read books so you don't have to. My name is Sam Johnson, and joining me today is...
Troy. How's it going, everybody?
Tom, hello.
And Chloe. Hey, hi, hello, how are ya?
For this week, we've read the entire collection of Rashomon, a collection of short stories by Ryunsuke Akutagawa.
Leave it.
Man, this is just like...
No, no, leave it.
I was talking over the weekend my wife and I went to Old Orchard Beach with my family.
And Tommy Teabag.
Tommy Teabag was there too. And I yelled at my mother because she gave me her brain, which is that when you're trying to pronounce or remember proper nouns, it's becoming increasingly difficult. I'm only 28.
Yeah, your brain is smoothing over the years.
Wouldn't you say Ryuna,
You got the brain?
In my brain it works.
You guys are sharing the
same. Ryunosuke
Akutagawa?
Ryunsuke Akutagawa.
It's Ryunosuke Akutagawa.
I know Suke is Ske.
That's the one.
No, because S-U-K-E is Ske, not Suke. It is.
Like Sasuke.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ryunosuke Akutagawa.
Yeah, see, she got it. So that's the...
And I'm illiterate,
That's
so.
The fucking author we read. He's pretty good. My original show notes were for 2 short stories, but because we've been on such a long hiatus, it is all of those short stories, including Rashomon, In the Grove, Yam Gruel, The Dragon, and some other fucking bullshit. We'll talk about the whole collection of short stories in general, but the 2 that we read that sort of stood out the most to me was In a Grove and Yam Gruel. In a Grove is the story that Akira Kurosawa's film Rashomon is based off of, and it deals with a murder and the various perspectives on that murder, from passing civilians to the policeman to the person who was murdered's ghost. And that was pretty compelling. And then we have the story of Yam Gruel, which is about a quote, spiritless samurai who his one goal in life is to get this this kind of aristocratic soup called Yam Gruel. And it's his adventure trying to get that. And it's all about the disappointment and like the desire to get what one wants and then not wanting it when you get it.
A man is just simping for gruel.
Yeah.
That's literally the entire story.
And it's a great one.
I love how Tom's nodding.
I read the Cliff Notes about 5 minutes ago.
Tell our beautiful, thick readers, listeners, why they don't read.
So I ordered a book which looks way better than you guys's, but mine is Rashomon and 17 other stories, one of which is not Yam Gruel.
It's a damn shame.
So
it's a yam shame.
Fuck yeah. Good pull, hon.
Ooh, can that be the title of the episode? Yam
it's
shame.
It's a yam shame. I can
it's
do
a
that.
Yam shame.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
But so the author, Ryunsuke Akutagawa, was considered...
Ooh, you put some flair on that one.
So
it sounded good.
This guy was considered a renegade of his time. He had a prolific, if short-lived, career as a writer. He was born in 1882. And died by suicide in 1927. He wrote in the Taisho period and rejected the main schools of literary thought at the time. He is considered the father of Japanese short stories, having produced 150 in his life. His story, In a Grove, as I said before, was directly used for Akira Kurosawa's film Rashomon. Interesting guy.
Question.
Answer.
Are you only reading Japanese authors who kill themselves?
Most Japanese authors do kill themselves.
Let's figure out why.
I mean, it's the stereotype that Japanese people just, you know, kill themselves. A lot of honor in the culture, and well, he wrote some pretty mediocre short stories, so that's all I gotta say.
Sounds like a bunch of quitters to me.
We're gonna fight about this. But before I get into that, I think that the explanation has more to do with, like, as we're engaging with this sort of like early post-Meiji literary movement, a lot of these writers have a kind of they've brought the romanticism of European literature into their literary moment, and that has a lot to do with, like, you know, sort of like the desperate attempt of individuals to, you know, master their circumstances but being unable to. It's a very kind of tragic thing, and especially when these literary figures are surrounded by such a rigid and dogmatic culture, they feel sort of, I don't know, overwhelmed by it. That would be my answer.
All right, that must be it.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Done. Check.
The only solution, yeah.
What is that? Sociology? Check.
Right.
Graduated.
Honorary PhD.
Fuck yeah.
Most honorable PhD.
Can I get a PhD for everything I say?
Just become famous enough.
If you speak fast enough and emphatically enough, people will just assume you know what the fuck you're talking about.
I know.
I live that truth every day.
You're a great example.
People always ask me for advice, and they should not.
Valid. So, as we were saying, those are the stories that he wrote.
End of episode. Dude. Tommy, you should do the fucking intros.
So, for what it's worth, listeners, dear listeners, Paul and Chris.
How you guys doing?
It's been a while for various reasons. The pandemic has caught up to all of us, I think, in its various
ways. Not
medically. Yeah, we haven't gotten COVID, but just like the idea of being inside all the fucking time. And
spiritually.
Yeah, spiritually, right.
Oh,
exactly.
I am spiritually
destitute.
It's kind of congested.
You know, I feel like Jesus is like wrapped in like a bunch of those like COVID molecules that they're showing all the fucking time, and he just can't get out.
Well, Jesus was just one of many prophets and rabbis.
No. Jesus is the Son of God.
Well,
he's the Messiah.
He was some schmuck.
I'm sorry, you can't accept him, and you had to kill him.
We'll have to wait.
Those were the fucking
real
Romans.
We're going to have to wait for
that was not the Romans.
Passion
I didn't
of the
watch
Christ
the movie.
2 to find out.
I'd
you have to what?
We're going to have to wait for Passion of the Christ 2 to find out.
Right, we have to find out the sequel. Yeah.
If Mel Gibson
how
ever
does
writes
story
a book,
actually end?
If Mel Gibson ever writes a book, we like contractually have to do it, right?
Did he not write a memoir or something? He seems like the kind of guy who would.
Wait, what the fuck? Why aren't you guys just doing that book?
A Mel Gibson unit?
Let's do a Melly Gibby unit.
Melly Gibby.
I'd be down for that. Can we just read the fucking like screenplays from all his movies?
Can we act it out?
Yeah, sure.
Cool.
I just want to see his anti-Semitic rants, and that can be, we just discuss.
We could act those out.
Good event.
Okay, cool.
Mel Gibson's greatest hits. And we just
Now that's what I call Mel Gibson.
Jesus Christ.
All right, cool. All
right, well, I mean, you have a mic. If you want to just stay on and ramble, that's fine with me.
I didn't read the fucking any of it, though.
You didn't read any of it?
Make jokes on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tap in every now and then.
Yeah.
I'll tap in.
Let's just make it happen.
Yeah. I'll be Alex. So I'll be like, I really thought that, you know, what I think is, you know, in like in a really like nice, gentle way, say something like, you know,
pass.
I'll be like, well, you know, Flannery O'Connor and, you know, Southern, when I think of novels in prose, in, you know, story.
You haven't finished a single sentence. Are you supposed to?
Well, I haven't listened to the podcast, so I don't know what he actually talks
right.
like about books.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think it was pretty spot on.
Alex does finish sentences.
He does, yeah.
From time to time.
I'm not going to give that guy too much credit. He's an asshole.
Dweeb.
But, yeah, total nerd. But he does finish his sentences, Chloe.
Yeah. If you're going to roast him accurately. Fucking dweeb.
All right.
I'm sorry. That's not fair.
Troy said in our group chat, was it today or yesterday, that you liked 9 inches, but now you're much more interested in 7 inches. listeners, guess what we were talking about?
Rulers.
Tom, you would know if you checked the fucking chat.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Let's look at that.
I think the listeners have had enough time to guess. Go ahead.
No, they got to tune in next epi.
And we're not going to remember next week.
No, this is called listener engagement. It's like part of podcasting.
We're not going to remember next week.
It's a call to action.
It's, I don't give a shit about
it's call to action. That's what our audience needs.
Call the hotline and tell us what you think, Troy, like 7 inches
They
of.
Don't even know about the hotline.
Call the hotline, number to be added later. Alex, plug it in here. And tell us what Troy likes 7 inches of. Ooh, it's a quiz show.
It's not a quiz show. It's a show about books.
Not all of us want to do that.
I'm going to turn your mic off.
Oh, man. All right, I'm tapping out. I'll come back later with more content.
All right. So what did we think of the short story collection overall? Troy, you kind of gave a preview that you didn't like it very much.
Some of them I liked. Some of them I thought, like, none of them were bad, but some of them were mediocre. Some of them were great. There's a good variety.
There's a good variety of quality. So what were the ones you liked the most, and what were the ones you liked the least?
I liked In a Grove. I think that was one of the better ones. The most bizarre one was Yam Gruel. I also enjoyed The Dragon. Was a weird one because it's like a story about a guy telling a story. It's very meta. I enjoyed that. I did not really care for Kessa and Morito. And then I thought, let me see, The Martyr and Rashomon were, like, they're all right. They're not terrible. They're not great. Like, I get the point of what it was, but also some of his writing is specifically, like, there isn't a point. It's just, this is a story. This is what happened. That's the end. There's not a whole lot of moral behind it. And I think the kind of, I don't know, abject nature of it is the point, that there isn't a point.
Yeah, I feel like these stories would hit harder if we were from Japan, because he's basing a lot of his stories off of old folktales, Japanese folktales that people would be familiar with. However, I mean, I think, to be honest, it was partly because of my mood that I liked it as much as I did. Not the same with The Broken Commandment. I think that was just a great book in general, and I probably would have liked it even if I was, like, mad, sad, or happy. But with this book in particular...
The three moods.
Yeah, right. But with this book in particular, it has a collection of short stories. The writing is pretty minimalistic. He's very direct in the way he writes. It does sound a little bit like The Brothers Grimm in a way. And I appreciated that for the most part. And actually, like The Martyr, for instance, I thought, I thought maybe the plot was a little bit weak, but I found it charming at the very least. You know?
But that one was actually based on a true story, which I thought was
right, yeah.
Really interesting. There's a lot of stuff with, like, Catholic priests going around the world, and there's, like, women who, like, disguise themselves as men, only at the very end be like, surprise, like, Mulandum. Peekaboo.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a little... I guess I'm in between the two of you. Probably... Yeah, I mean, so I didn't read all the same stories you guys did, because some I read other ones you probably did not read.
That's true.
But overall, like, his writing style was good. It was easy. It wasn't super in-depth. I think minimalistic is the right way to put it. But I did find that the vast majority of them were engaging. I got through them really quick, and I liked the way the story moved, and I thought it was a good read. I didn't think any of them were particularly great. I will tell you, for me... I don't think you guys had any of these in your book, but the last six in my book were all, like, basically, like, autobiographies, short story versions of him.
Okay.
Pretty fucking good. It's like being in the mind of a psychopath, because he goes through all... Not a psychopath. What's the word I'm looking for?
Sociopath?
Of a very depressed, broken man.
Oh.
And it's literal accounts. I mean, do you know anything about why he, like, committed suicide and stuff?
No.
He just saw no purpose in life, basically, at a certain point.
It's typically how it goes, yeah.
Well, yes. That's why you no longer live. That was a dumb thing to say.
Now people are
like, keep going.
Man, I got, like, a full life. I got a family, you know. I have a purpose. And then they're like, better commit seppuku.
This is true. But I mean, I didn't get to look into too much about what it was as far as drug addiction and stuff like that, but he was basically, like, medicated the shit out of towards the end of his life. The last two stories I read were published after he had committed suicide, and they were written in the last, 12 to 18 months that he was alive. And it was very, like, dark. Just like he was basically writing down all the stuff that was happening to him on a day-to-day basis in short story form, and it was very interesting. You'll have to read them.
I need to have your copy. I'm going to have to either borrow it or get my own.
We can trade, because then I can read the ones that I wasn't able to read. But yeah, so anyways, it's ones that you definitely should read, because I liked, like I said, there was a lot of the short stories, you know, mine's in a bamboo grove, but, you know, Dragon were okay stories, good stories, you know, somewhere on the scale between 5 out of 10 to 8 out of 10 was probably the best one I read. But just the interest of his, you know, autobiography, short story telling of the end period of his life and just how broken of a man he was and like how aware he was of his situation and the decisions that he made. Super crazy. It was like being in his mind at the end of his life through short story form. Not that it was written extremely well. It was just, I don't think I've ever read anything in that style before.
That's really good. I mean, I'm willing to sort of, I like critiquing the way people write if it is bad. I think there are many ways to write good, I guess is the way I'd put it. And I actually liked the way in which he wrote. I think the style that he chose served his purposes, right? He's writing old medieval tales in sort of a modern dialect, a retelling of these stories. And I thought also that he kept that aesthetic.
But important to note, though, and Tom, I know that you mentioned this, you have a different translation, right?
Yeah, I do.
So that can play a huge role just in terms of, because I mean, structurally it could be the same, but it might just not hit the way yours hit.
Yeah, it might read differently.
Yeah.
But I liked him. I definitely liked him more than what saying. I mean, I thought that there was a couple weird ones that were a little bit hard to follow. But the ones that I thought were good, I thought were, you know, I don't know, top 20% short stories that I've read. I liked the writing style. It read good. The story was engaging. I'm not knocking it at all. He had some mediocre ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me at least, the weakness comes from like his inspiration.
I'm also just not a huge short story fan, so
that's you like fair. It any, long.
Any short stories, at least 7 inches.
Right. So like for instance, I think the best story that we could all agree on is In a Grove, right? That was the most compelling one. But even so, I think it was a little bit tarred for me because when I read it after I read about the story. Yeah, so it was slightly ruined for me because the analysis of it beforehand in the intro and then in other places that I've read is it's supposed to be about this idea of like one event has multiple perspectives and how you reconcile that sort of relativistic thing, right? Everybody has their own point of view and therefore facts can't be correlated perfectly, right? You can't have an objective accounting of that event. And in a grove, that is just not the case. Like, that is not the point that is being made. Somebody's lying. There's no way for all of those events to have occurred. And there's really no way for an individual to interpret them as such.
Who do you think is lying?
I mean, I don't know. I guess that's the point is, like, if everybody lies, right? But, like, the way in which I read the criticism, you know, not the actual, like, critique of it, but the analysis of that story was that it wasn't a story about people lying. It was a story about people understanding events differently. And I think the lying goes a lot more with the guy who wanted to kill himself, right? Than the everybody's perspective is equally valid kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I don't feel
fucking
like...
fucking libcuck storyline.
Akutagawa was not a libcuck.
See?
No.
Yeah, I feel like early 1900s Japan, that was not the every viewpoint is valid. I don't feel like that was their idea or their thinking.
No, I don't think that was the
not even from the generalized the renegade short story writer Akutagawa.
Yeah,
well, and he blatantly, like in my book, there's a few short stories that like literally, I don't know what yours do or say what your stories do, but like there'll be a full paragraph in like three different ones, mind you, there's 18 stories in this book, that it's just like he just writes like I had to make a deadline for a paper, so I wrote this, like the story is the story. Like it's not like he spent like a grueling amount of time on some of the ones that I read. It was just like he got a job from a magazine or a paper to write a story, and he was like at the deadline and didn't have anything and just like pumped out a story.
Right.
I don't think In a Grove is one of those, but there was a few that I read. They still weren't awful. But it was just like...
No, talented guy. But yeah, he definitely strikes me as the kind of dude who doesn't like, you know, like, for instance, I'm trying to remember the name of the story, but there's like a... Fuck, what is it called? It's a woman's name, but it's a James Joyce short story. And like, whatever, famously, he's like, he spent like, whatever, I don't know, months on this short story. It's like 5 pages. So it's like every single word was just meticulously picked. Like right. It was very intentional writing. And I don't feel like that's the case with Akutagawa.
No.
Joyce is also just deranged in that
yeah.
way,
so. Indeed. So, Tom, what were your... I mean, we didn't read the same stories, but, like, which ones jumped out to you besides the autobiographical ones?
The ones that jumped out the most was... I mean, really, the one that jumped out the most was In a Grove. Rashomon was pretty good. Dragon was kind of all over the place. It was a so-so story. But, I mean, In a Grove was the one that I think I got the best idea of... When he, it seemed to me like the story that he like sat down and intentionally wrote and really put a lot more into it. And he had different perspectives going on. There was a lot of things left open to the reader, I felt, where you were kind of trying to piece this story together from different perspectives. Thought it was just really well written. That one stuck out to me the most. And then obviously the autobiographical ones were just super interesting. But I got to be honest with you, for a short story writer, I like him a lot. I really do. I mean, I'm not a huge short story person either, but I didn't find myself bored at any point reading what he wrote. I could pick it up and some of them were 10 pages and some of them were 20 pages or 25 pages. And I at least liked all of them. I didn't read any of them and I was like, well, this story's not going anywhere. This is crap. It was just like some of them were eh, but some of them I was, you know, before I knew it, I was done. And I was like, not a bad story.
Nice.
Pretty sweet.
Don't have much to add to that.
Can I ask my question?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So, Sam, you mentioned in the beginning that you have a sense that these stories are based on or inspired by, or some of them at least, are based on like Japanese folk tales or you know, folk tales or folklore and stuff like that that we just have no fucking like reference to, as 200 years later, American readers, right? So my question is, that brought to mind, like, okay, so how might a Japanese person or someone who isn't familiar with our folklore and folktales, how would they receive works that are based on our legends and stuff like that? And the only one that could come to mind, it's a movie, and I watched it recently, so it jumped to my mind immediately, was O Brother, Where Art Thou, which is just a retelling of the Odyssey. Like, does that, you know, how would that resonate? Would it feel... Maybe not that specifically, if you guys have other examples. I just wonder how that flips.
So I think, I mean, I don't know. I don't know too many American folk tales in general.
Although, sure you do. Ichabod, Johnny Appleseed.
Ichabod Crane.
Headless Horseman. Or even Western ones. Think Aesop's Fables.
So like Hansel and Gretel?
Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, Brothers Grimm stuff.
Yeah, Little Red Riding Hood. So fairy tales. There's also all the Aesop's Fables. Like,
right.
Where we get like most of our fucking expressions from,
mm-hmm.
Or like, you know, mythology things that we just like hold on to.
So I think at least maybe that's why my mind wasn't jogged, was because like the Odyssey is it is technically a folk tale, but like it is considered a great work of literature and is something that somebody like Akutagawa would be familiar with.
Right.
On some
So that wasn't a good example in that it's not a folk tale, but it's something that
but, like Little Red
it's a
Riding
modern,
Hood,
but it's
yeah.
a modern telling of an old ass story.
Yeah.
Okay. So, let's say, I don't know, let's say someone wrote a book about Johnny Appleseed, you know, we all know about that dude who walked the fuck around with his, like, tin thing on his hat.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, what kind of material does that give to a foreign reader? And is that always going to be a problem, or is there a way to do it to make it stand on its own? Those kinds of things, talk about that, whatever.
So I think, at least from my point of view, like, Akutagawa did that recommends it is that he made all of his stories like very distinctly modern, right? Like they felt close in a way, right? Because they were dealing with things that were like seedy and desperate.
Everything's
like,
very dark.
Right. Yeah. Like the Rashomon story. And it seems like every story ends with like, you know, into the void, you know, like something about the darkness, like creeping up on you. And like the Rashomon story, right, is just a servant who gets kicked out of a house, right? So this is clearly the end of the Meiji period, you know, the whole feudal hierarchy is falling apart. And he goes into the Rashomon, which is like the threshold of Kyoto. It's the bear, like the actual guard posts that lead into the city. And he goes into the building of the Rashomon, and there's a lady just picking hair out of a dead body's head in order to make things to sell. And then it's sort of like this weird conflict between the servant and this old woman. And that's really dark, right? Like that feels like something I would see in a movie or something like that. And that's what makes the folktales come to life, right? Whereas like Yam Gruel is a cute story, right? And accessible, but it does feel farther away in this sense. But also like the message of like, this is the thing you desire, and when you get it, you don't want it, right, anymore, or like being picked on, like those are kind of universal human emotions. And I think with like Western fairy tales, you know, in order to deliver that properly, you wouldn't read the original one, right? You would retell that story in a like a mode of emotion that modern readers would understand and feel.
Well, that makes me think then, you know, not just telling a story in a mode that is like, you know, of the time of the reader or speaks to, you know, maybe the current, for those readers of that time period, like their current anxieties and things like that, right? It makes me wonder, so then what makes a folktale valuable? Is it its ability to be retold in different ways so many times? Or is it that touch of familiarity? You know, is that what would allow a reader to focus on the tone more than the story itself?
I mean, those
because
are both,
you guys were,
right?
But you guys were kind of doing both. You had to focus on what was happening. You wouldn't have that sense of what's coming next. If you were reading something, you're like, oh, this is Hansel and Gretel. Like some weird witch is going to eat these kids or something to represent that. Like that element of,
Well, the thrill.
You kind of miss by not knowing it.
The thrill of the retelling of a story is in the twists that you add, right? So like, you
or
can
is it in the tastiness of the things that touch?
Well, it could be, right? It could be both. But I'm saying is like what makes a retelling of something like really, at least for me, really satisfying is like if a story is retold, but it's told from a perspective I didn't expect or like some sort of event happened that I didn't expect. You know, you look at like if we're comparing, contrasting like something like The Odyssey with O Brother, Where Art Thou, the different characters and situations, it's not an automatic lineup. And the new environment and the way in which those different roles of the Odyssey are interpreted are what make that story compelling. I think the familiarity is what drives home that change, right? Like, it's like anything. I mean, we can think about when we watched Attack on Titan, right? It's an action anime. Action animes have certain tropes.
Oh, and it is with a cast of kids.
It's with a cast of kids who are all banding together to go defeat a big enemy, except for instead of winning all the time, a lot of them fucking die.
Which smacks in the face of that classic band of kid anime trope, which is the power of friendship saves us all.
Right. There's a you know, in every action anime, there's always a moment in which the friends are being hurt or gonna be killed, and then the good guy gets all of his power and he defeats the bad guy.
Such as in the best anime of all time, Naruto.
Yeah, but in Attack on Titan,
podcast.
In Attack on Titan, there's many situations in which characters die. And in any other genre, that might not be important,
well,
right?
People died in Naruto.
No, but I'm saying is that in other genres of media, right, people dying might not be as important or as jarring. But in an action anime, anybody who grew up on that, it's fucking jarring.
Yeah.
So then my question is, so then as a foreign reader, taking in the mood and the tone and the twists to these stories, like, it's tricky because you're coming at it from a pretty blank slate. So I wonder if that mood is like hits even heavier for a Japanese reader. How cool could that be, you know?
I feel like there's a heavy dose of just being morose or like downtrodden, like you're saying at the end of Rashomon. It's just like he literally runs off into the void. He talks with the old woman about whether, she could be better. And then she says, well, the woman that I'm like pulling the dead hair out of, she used to kill snakes and sell it as fish. Like, she sucked too. You're probably just going to become a thief. And then he gets all mad. He like pushes her down into the corpses and then he just runs off into the night to become a thief. And I was like, it's just dark, and I feel like, yeah, some of that familiarity would just make it even more brutal in that sense.
No, I think it would add like an extra layer to it for sure. But I mean, there's definitely something that we're missing, not knowing, you know, the background to, you know, the folklore and like the things that he is writing alongside with. And so I think we're not getting like the full impact that we could, but he also does a really good job of modernizing the stories to the time period that he's writing in, that I can imagine being relatable to like late 1800s, early 1900s Japan. And then his own writing style, like the dark value, I didn't really like know where it was coming from until, and I know I keep referencing the stories, but I do need to read you this. It's this last section of the last story that's in this book. Okay.
Was this the last story he wrote before he died?
I'm not sure if it was the last one he wrote before he died, but this is one of the ones that was published after he had committed suicide.
Ooh, posthumously.
Correct. It says it right here. Posthumous. So he goes through this whole story. It's, you know, it's basically about this like blinding pain that he has. You know, it's called, Jesus, what's the name of it?
Owie.
It's called like the grinding gears or something. And it's like this thing where he's got an issue where he gets these gears start showing up in his vision and he gets like a headache. And his only remedy is basically to like drink whiskey and like he meanders around like Tokyo and whatever. It's pretty
horrible,
depressing.
Yeah.
It's pretty depressing. But this is the last line. Or the last couple sentences. It says, I don't have the strength to keep writing this. To go on living with this feeling is painful beyond description. Isn't there someone kind enough to strangle me in my sleep?
And that is the perspective of our author.
And the rest of the story isn't any brighter.
So he
you.
Wasn't a well man.
No, he was not well.
Did he lift?
He definitely did not. I've seen pictures of him. Oh. Very small man. Cool. Kind of a weird looking dude, too.
1 out of 10, where is he?
1 out of 10? Probably
yeah,
like a 4.
Yeah, 4. I mean, he's a normal-sized Japanese man.
No.
Like, how good-looking is
he?
Oh,
do you think that the 1 to 10 scale is just size-related?
Well, I thought it was in context that did he lift?
Is this another, is this another pretty-ass situation?
The answer is if you're under 5'11", you're a 1. If you're 6 foot or above, you're 10. That's the answer.
It's a simple equation.
It's hard.
Quite unbeatable.
It's hard being a manlet.
So there's no ones in this, or there's no tens in this room.
No tens. Just ones.
Well, I'm like a clean 7.
Yeah. Are you over 6 feet?
Right. Yeah.
I'm multiple D cups. So the woman's scale.
Yeah, this is a man's scale.
Oh.
This is a man's world. Oh, this is a man's pod.
But to your point previously, I think that to Chloe's question.
It's a good question, though, right?
It is a good question. And I do think that you know, Akutagawa is remembered, is quoted as being the father of the Japanese short story, which means that his stories resonated with people because short stories are things that are published in magazines. Mm-hmm. They're things that have mass distribution. And so people must have grabbed onto that. And I think especially with the period he's writing in, right, these are stories that people knew from childhood that he was retelling in a way that spoke to their current anxieties, their current problems. And I think that's probably where most of his power comes through. And anything we get from these stories is kind of like a glancing blow to that reality.
Because you mentioned that what you love about short stories is those twists. What makes a twist is you have to think you know what's coming.
Right,
right,
exactly.
You have to have a sense of what's coming. And then when it doesn't or when something else comes in its place, you go, ooh.
Yeah, I make that noise every single time.
Well, no, that's like a classical literary term. Like, I'm sure that
like
our... there's also another literary term. I won't do my joke, but...
No, go ahead.
Well, it's inappropriate.
Yeah. Okay.
That's another literary term.
I've seen that more in videos than in...
I haven't come across that much in my reading.
Yeah. Isn't that like a cinematic type thing?
Like the same movies just in videos.
Yeah.
Videos.
Well, it's more of a director's move.
Yeah, I used to get those at Blockbuster.
Nutbusters.
That's fucking good shit.
All right.
But yes, I definitely think we were missing that portion of this. You know, I think, and the one that kind of like sticks with me that you mentioned is like a Hansel and Gretel thing. Mm. Like, I wonder if you took a Hansel and Gretel story and made it not about Hansel and Gretel, but like the same, if you just took the bare bones of the story and somebody with really good you know, writing ability.
People do it all the time. Yeah.
Funny you mention that. Our very own Ham Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, I literally am writing a story about Hansel and Gretel, but two conquistadors.
Oh.
So.
Originally, well, I haven't read one, not by you or by anybody.
Yeah, but the story is being about, like, the witch, super depressed. Like,
Sam, originally you were going to write that story about two conquistadors who embodied the personalities of our cats. So one would be, like, really loud and impulsive and stupid, and the other one would just be, like, lazy and studious and, you know, perhaps a little gluttonous, one would say. Yeah, but he forgot to do that part.
But
how cute would that be?
You might have read a story like that and you just didn't know it, right. You know, because like the only things you need to make a Hansel and Gretel story is two people who are together
trying to find their way back,
left somewhere lost, and then find some sort of obstacle that they overcome and then find their way home.
Right.
Like, that's a Hansel and Gretel story.
Right. That's the bone.
And the only thing that you would add to make it even more obvious is something to do with fucking breadcrumbs. You know.
Right.
Except for this time, they follow the Skittles.
Tom, you're smart.
You're a literary genius.
I'm telling you, I've written a lot of stories in my time.
I bet you have.
I have not.
I've written a lot of stories.
I've written so many fucking stories.
Troy, do you have anything to add as far as books are concerned?
In terms of Yam Gruel, I just really liked all of the small little pieces that they added to show that the samurai was a loser. Like, nobody below him actually respected him. Like, kids made fun of him. It specifically talked about how his sword had, like, the leather around it wasn't well done. And it was like, who cares? But I thought it was funny that he went into that much detail just to show how much this samurai sucks. He has, like, stains on his kimonos. People at court made fun of him. He's almost like more like the jester. And then as he's going, you just feel the condescension of the noble that takes him along. He like is doing it almost as a joke and on a whim, and it's like, oh, come with me. And then like 20 pages later, he's still doing it. And then it's not a joke anymore. The guy's just super sad and like staring into his bowl of yam gruel, and his life has no meaning anymore.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a really smart thing. Like I said in the beginning, I think Yam Gruel is the most old feeling of all of the stories.
Dark Horse, best story of the bunch.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, it did that very folksy thing of with the fox, you know, writing from the fox's perspective, which I thought was really nice. And the story had a good clip to it, and... although I thought actually that Akutagawa did a really good job of not, like, Goi, the spiritless samurai.
Excuse me?
His name is Goi. He sounded like Akutagawa did a good job of making Goi sound like kind of lifeless, right? And maybe oblivious, but he wasn't stupid, you know?
No,
he kind of accepted his lot in life.
Yeah, he knew that people were making fun of him, but he was just... I don't know. He's neutral about it. He like didn't have enough energy to care because he's busy thinking about yam gruel.
The simp for yam gruel.
Yeah, busy simping for yam gruel. Travels across Japan to get this gruel of yams. Like,
I just love that scene where it's like he's looking at the courtyard as they're filling it with yams, and he's like, "Holy shit, that's a fucking lot of yams, dog.
Them's be some big yams."
I couldn't get those yams all day.
It also makes me think, so I know that it's deeper in the point of he gets what he wants and then he's not happy. But it also makes me think of the movie Matilda, where they feed the fat kid chocolate cake until he's like about to die. And it almost feels like everybody at the table is making fun of him. Is like, bring him another cup of yam gruel. And he's not like even aware of it. He's busy just like having his own little existential crisis, but they're still making fun of him. Like, everybody in the room is making fun of him.
Yeah, I thought that's how the story was going to end. I thought the story was going to end, like, because it was, I don't know, after reading enough of the short stories, I was like, okay, who dies? You know, like, you know, what's the dark side of things? I thought Goi was going to be forced to, like, you know, be fed yam gruel until his fucking stomach explodes or something like that. But it actually ended pretty mildly.
I'd love to add something, but I only read the cliff notes. I know what you're talking about, but I don't have any like input.
Just what, fucking say it anyway,
what
bro.
What Rashomon short story collection is complete without Yam Gruel?
I'm really Rashomon. Not. I'm a little disappointed because it's a nice book, but the way you guys are talking about this one, I'm just like, how'd you miss that? Unless it's just one I happen to not read and it's translated differently, but the only one that comes close is called Green Onions.
So, I feel like that is not a translation error.
Yeah, I don't think so. I really have a hard time believing that Yam Gruel can be translated in any other way except for Yam Gruel.
That's what I think.
Maybe Yam Soup, but like a noun's a noun. Like a yam is a yam. It's not
it's
a
true.
Yam.
It's not a green onion.
It's also a sweet potato in most grocery stores, though.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, why... You know, or would be called.
You know,
sweet
they
potato.
Label yams as sweet right. potatoes, and they're yeah. just.
If
they're
it was
different.
Like sweet potato stew or something, I'd be like, okay, yeah, like somebody right. just maybe botched the translation, but does not seem to be the case. Although with you guys talking about it, it makes me kind of sad.
Makes you want some yam gruel, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it doesn't make me sad that I didn't read it. Although I do want to. We'll switch books so I can read the ones that I didn't read, and you can read the depressing ending. Of
hell yeah, dude!
Of his life,
I want to hear about his suicide.
But, no, it just sounds like a kind of sad story that this guy's just got, like, a shit lot in life, and he's just really wanting some yam gruel. Everyone's making fun of him, and he's, you know, a samurai. Which I would imagine reading that from a Japanese perspective is like, damn, this is where the samurai have come.
You know what makes me sad yeah. is that the thing he's simping over is literally yam, like, soup.
Yeah.
Like, of all
yams
the things.
Yams is good, though.
I know,
yams,
but like
the power that beat that.
But
beat.
Like the one like, thing, if it's like, oh, I can only have one thing that I'm going to eat before I die, yams is not what I'm going to choose.
But I feel like that's probably just the specific pussy. Thing. That's true. Drown in the pussy. Before I get too far off track, I'm curious from you guys. So think of, I tried to think of this and I couldn't come up with a good like equivalent, but. So take like Yam Gruel as a story, right? It's a story that is talking about a class of people that has fallen to this point, and he's expressing what's happening. And I specifically think that he picked yams to be like a, because if he was like, you know, I really want like Kobe beef, like this thing that's really hard to get, and I'll like travel across Japan to get it. That might be one thing, but I think it was specifically chosen to be something that like is the reader's going to be like, really? This is what you're simping over? So my question is, like, what nowadays in like in the society that we live in, do you think like a class of people, what would you pick would be a class of people that like would fall that far and we'd be like, holy hell, like... What happened to society?
So I think that the yams were, they were more difficult to get when the story takes place, right? So it is considered an aristocratic dish, but I do think your point still stands that it's probably more commonplace in the contemporary period of the writer. But I would say is the thing I would say is that anything involving ice. So like ice is super commonplace now. And we would
cool
be able to
refrigeration
do it.
Is like a would have you know your Sam and Tom your father once made the point that there is no poverty in America because everyone has a refrigerator. He was like,
refrigerators
well,
don't produce ice though.
Okay, well no, but he was but my point still stands. He was like,
yeah,
he was saying
say
people
that.
Can preserve their food, so it's like not you're not really poor. Like you can you know just have buy food. More like buy food and store it. And I was like, Steve, what? But in his mind, when he thinks of poverty, he thinks of like people living in like an old timey like sharecropper shack.
In the arms,
like for real. So like the freezing cold ice thing is a good point because your brain damaged father believes that.
That's true.
You can cut this.
Depravity is relative.
But so there's actually a funny story about Napoleon who gets made fun of because he doesn't know what ice is when he goes to the military academy. And it was at that moment that dawned on me that, like, ice was actually pretty hard to have before. And I think that that would be a funny retelling of the story.
That's
it's
a good
like,
point.
It's like something like ice cream or, like, you know, the only thing he wants is, like, a fucking glass of lemonade or something like that.
Yeah.
With, like ice cold lemonade.
Something that, like, actually needs to be kept, like, very cool, if not frozen. Which is commonplace
right.
for us now.
Yeah, we can
it was
just
very
go,
simple.
We can get fucking... Ben and Jerry's DoorDash to us these days, but like,
but there was a long period of time.
Don't make a promise you can't keep.
Howdy, friends. Howdy, friends. We're back.
What's up, my friends?
The letter of the week is S for suicide.
Or sad.
Mostly suicide.
That's true.
Sammy.
You can kill yourself when you're happy, too.
This is a bad podcast.
You could have just ended it right there. You could kill yourself.
Speaking of ending it.
Yeah.
Suicide.
Yeah. Right. Speaking of ending it.
My doctor says that we're going to fix that.
Well, no, I wasn't pointing at you because you're sad. Jesus fucking Christ.
It's passive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
just like me.
So how do we feel about killing ourselves?
So team.
Well, you know, I'd be lying to you.
Everyone thinks about
it. Let's have a podcast deep cut. Let's get into our suicidal ideations.
Hey, nothing makes you depressed. Well, I was just going to say, nothing makes you depressed like this whole pandemic and like the way our country is fucking crumbling in itself. Just being like, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah, I feel you, dog.
Pretty rough.
It is, and it's like none of it makes any sense. Like nobody, like everybody's all just kind of like, I don't know, screaming at the void, it feels like.
I've become so pessimistic about things, it's actually, I wouldn't say alarming, but definitely concerning. Just like my knee-jerk reaction to politics nowadays, or even like current events, because they all end up being like swung in one side of politics or the other, then the whole pandemic happening, my knee-jerk reaction is to be like, fuck you, fuck this, what's the point?
A little Akutagawa.
That's
feeling.
Life, man. That's life.
Yeah, which, you know, back to S for suicide.
Ooh, so good.
So, is it suicide if you lick a COVID patient and you die?
No.
No, that's just...
I want to go out the way Hemingway went out.
Just like blow
suicide.
Himself away with a shotgun? Isn't that what he did?
Yeah, but when you like live life to the fullest and it's like, all right, yeah, I'm done.
Or like Hunter S. Thompson. He's like, Thompson. I'm good.
No, because he got sad and bummery.
I don't
want to,
Chris. Just
I don't know why
just,
he got so upset yeah. that the football season ended.
We're just bullying yeah. half of our. We're bullying 50% of our base right now.
Chris, you don't need to call in and correct us. We get it. It's a metaphor. Yada yada yada.
Is
it a metaphor
for
baseball? if right? Tom Brady never plays again, I might axe myself.
Yeah, no, Tom. Right? Tom Brady, you have to keep playing for the Buccaneers, otherwise my brother will kill himself.
Done. I don't actually care that much, but
well,
your
no, I mean,
does.
It's just like every Tom that him. Was born Jesus. Into this world is a useless piece of shit, except for Tom Brady.
I know.
So when he dies, then there's no more good Tom.
We're
what
back
about
down
Thomas,
to the trenches.
What yeah. about Thomas O'Malley, the alley cat from Aristocats,
yeah, or my
the
Uncle
hot
Tom.
Cat who yeah. fucked the white
also,
cat.
He's not real.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's got to be a real person.
Yeah, you can't
oh,
be.
Oh,
you can't
oh,
invest
oh,
your
oh.
hopes and dreams into
wait,
fucking
so
Thomas
to
O'Malley,
wait,
alley
so who,
cat.
So who are the only two good Toms? Is it Tom Johnson and
no,
Uncle
it's,
Tom?
No, it's Tom Moore and Tom Brady. Tom Johnson is not
Tom Johnson
good.
Sucks
okay.
ass. Do you, though?
Back, well.
Whoa.
So back to suicide.
I wouldn't call it a suck.
You're not just like, come here, honey. Does Val listen to this?
No.
I love that.
All right, so let's back to suicide. I want to bring this conversation back away from Val and toward suicide.
Correct.
That's what we've all been trying to do for years now.
Though we haven't read him yet, we're going to mm-hmm. read Mishima, who we know kills himself in the end.
Whoa, spoiler alert. S for spoilers.
Okay, yeah. If you're spoiled by that, then go read
best,
a fucking book.
Wait, best Instagram account? Right now, fake Mishima.
Yeah.
It's so a good fucking one. Funny. I think Alex runs it, if I'm being 100% honest.
It kind of feels that way, yeah.
Because
yeah.
he is our gay fascist friend. Right. He's our friend.
No, he's gay fascist curious. He's not
right.
gay
he's
fascist.
Preoccupied with gay fascism.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
He's fascinated by strong men with right-wing political beliefs.
You could say he's fascinated.
Fascinated. Nice.
Yeah. Ooh. Okay. Suicide.
So we've had, Mishima commit suicide, Akutagawa commit suicide, even... is it Tosin, the guy who wrote the Broken Commandment? He didn't kill himself, but he definitely sacrificed his children on the way to becoming a literary, you know, phenomenon. So death, or like the sacrifice of oneself, or the things people care about, is a prominent theme in this. So, how do we feel about suicide in general? And then, like, how do we think that experience or that thought about suicide sort of maps onto this set of authors we're reading?
I think the big difference in our, you know, modern Western conception of suicide versus these schmucks is that there is, like, you know, there isn't a feeling of honor in suicide for us. It is, you know, if you commit suicide, it's because you were, you know, weak to handle your mental problems.
You failed
to access services. You know, all of these things that, you know what I mean? There isn't a sense of it's an acceptable way to go.
But there's different kinds of suicide. This is not, Akutagawa's suicide is not the same thing as Mishima's suicide.
No, not
yeah,
even.
But I'm also, Mishima's but my point is what examples of modern Western honorable suicide is there? See what I mean, though? So when we say suicide, the first thing that comes to mind in all of our conceptions of it is, ooh, that bad, though.
But what's funny about it is I don't feel that way in the context of Japanese culture, especially in these time periods.
I think one reason for that, and where I was kind of trying to go with that, but I did like a really bad job, was like modern Western everything is so focused on the self and the actualization of the self. So to end the self is the ultimate failure. There can be no honor in that. Whereas a lot of Eastern cultures and Japan and a lot of the, you know, it's a lot of sacrificing the self toward the greater goal or toward history or toward these other things or toward, you know, if you can't succeed in this larger than self purpose, what is the self then? So there's that difference in like priority.
So I would alter what you said slightly.
Yeah, I don't read.
So I would say that like, the idea of like the one man who stands up, you know, and does the self-sacrificial thing by which to die, right? Which is a form of suicide, but suicide for a purpose is a common Western theme. You know, it's the idea of like the hero, right? The sacrificial martyr hero who goes and dies for a good cause. I would say though that the seppuku idea, right? Of like killing oneself for your honor, right? Like you're killing yourself because of how the community now views you. You're viewed as a failure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so
well, I wasn't talking about like, you know, letting yourself die for a cause. I'm not talking about a hero in war. I'm talking about actively killing yourself, not being a martyr for something.
You said like for history, for, you know, higher ideals. So that,
well, I wasn't talking about Jesus. You know what I mean? Like I was talking,
I'm not talking about Jesus either. I'm talking about like for a war.
Yeah, he did not,
you know.
But I was, but I'm, fun fact for
who?
Jesus did not,
he died for
suicide.
Our sins.
No.
Like, he died for your sins. But like my point is, no, but I'm saying I'm excluding that because that isn't quite suicide. You know, it's really,
well, I mean,
not.
Yeah, but
is it?
I don't know. Oh, great.
Yeah, is it?
Well, yeah, I guess that's up for debate. But I see what you're saying, Sam, because it's not like seppuku isn't killing yourself for like the emperor and to progress a cause. You're killing yourself because of your name, your honor, and how you're perceived by the community because of something.
Well, right. They thought that the heart or your soul was like in the stomach, so you're literally exposing the stomach to show that you have honor, like, right. You are, people think you're dishonorable, so you cut it open so like it will fall out and everyone can see that you do still have honor.
That sounds,
yeah, that's
fucking
like,
smart.
It's the reclamation of your honor. That is right. Your way of atoning for whatever thing happened. Mm-hmm. But it's not like,
no wonder,
you know,
they
it's
didn't
not,
win the fucking
it's not
war.
A Jim Jones mass suicide for something that like isn't a thing.
Right. And though, you know, Mishima is a bit of a old-fashioned character, if we can call it that, Akutagawa is very modern in the way he kills himself, right?
Yeah.
He kills himself because he's desperate, because he sees no point in existing.
Yeah, he was a very depressed person. I mean, it was just like, you know, you can see it in his writing. You can definitely see it in his autobiographical writing. Like, it was, and that equates a lot more to like, you know, my experience with what would be, you know, Western, you know, depression and suicide and things are happening. Like he actually, you know, if you look at it in a bubble, he was a, you know, relatively successful, if not very successful writer. He was prominent. You know, he talks in a couple of his stories at the end about, you know, how he hated that, you know, people would come up to him and they call him sensei. And he's like, what a fucking joke. Like he was
right,
like,
look at me.
He resented it, but that's how he was looked at by people. So in a bubble, you look at it like, okay, wow, like you're a talented writer. You know, have these connections. You have a job. You're a prominent person. People in the streets just like will see you and know who you are and like want to talk to you. And yet you're still like wildly depressed and like, like a fish out of water, and you're like, what's the point of this? And then you kill yourself. And like that corresponds a lot more to, you know, suicide in the United States than seppuku does.
Yeah, I mean, nobody kills themselves for honor in America.
Right.
No, it's like one of the least honorable things you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the element of the, maybe it's Catholicism or like Christianity in general, right? Like it's a,
don't look at me.
You're sinning against sort of God's creation by killing yourself, which could be an element of it. Although I do think that the commonality, right, between Akutagawa and like modern Western suicide is this lack of place, right? I think that might be even accentuated in Akutagawa suicide because, you know, in traditional society with, you know, longstanding hierarchies that are like respected and understood by social custom, you know, when you're born or rather when you become conscious of your own social situation, what that social situation is going to end up. You kind of have your life's purpose in a way. Because you know the direction that your life is going to take and where it should end, right? You know the requirements that are available to you to have a good life, right? Maybe not everybody's satisfied with that, but most people are. In modern society, where you're presented with so many choices, right? It's very unclear what it means to live a good life, right? By social standards. Those change rapidly. And though, you know, other individuals, you know, maybe important ones to you, like your parents or maybe particular, like, you know, people who are prominent in society tell you what you should be, those ideas become deprecated and change rapidly throughout your life. And I think it produces a kind of cynicism and a kind of nihilism that we can observe in our author.
I think when we think about, and I'm speaking specifically like the American perspective on suicide, you know, there is an expectation of social mobility or a universal potential for that. We are fed that from day fucking one. So suicide in a world where you are, once you're born, you allegedly have the potential to become something great, you know. You never stop grinding. I'll see you at the bank. Like, you know, Henry Ford, like all of these, like, you know, American dream, my
Isn't
friend.
Isn't that the American dream? Rapping?
Honestly? Yeah.
Yeah.
That is social mobility.
It totally
right?
is.
So there is this dream of social mobility. So to commit suicide is the greatest cop out of that Americanness. You know, it completely absolves or it abdicates from you your participation in this shared conception of what it means to be right, which is to keep going forward, to keep trying to go through trials and tribulations and keep trying for the thing,
yeah,
whatever that may be.
It's a very youthful perspective, too.
America's a young place, though,
because you got to think. Well, I mean, it is a young place in general as a nation, but you got to think about like. You know, there's an incredible amount of suicides happening in these, like, you know, rural Rust Belt towns, right? Who are, like...
These old-ass towns.
They've been left by the economic prosperity that they used to have, right, 40 years ago. And the people there who stayed there don't know what to do anymore. So
the suicide rate on, like, Native American reservations is, like, bonkers high compared to other places.
Yeah.
Like, bonkers.
Right, but, like, and this is not... I am not trying to diminish the plight of the Native Americans or anything like that.
Well, they're also crazy impoverished, though.
I agree. But I'm saying, so, you know, there's the desperateness that comes from poverty and there's the desperateness that comes from once having something and losing it.
From that potential being gone.
Yeah. And so I'm saying is that like what the recent trend in increase has been basically in older white, you know, families for there to be more suicides in the adult population because they don't see any point in continuing because... They used to have that potential. They used to have the good job with the pension and the health care and, you know, the cars and stuff. And that was taken away from them. And they're too old and too,
right, and
you
rent,
know, maybe
and
not
rent,
bright enough.
And
Rent-A-Center
keeps calling and there's no jobs left in town.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and they just think, okay, well, I'll just take pills and then eventually kill myself.
Well, and I also
so
like,
wait, are we pro old person suicide or not?
No.
No?
I'm not. Pro-suicide in general. However, I definitely sympathize, especially with, you know, the way society handles itself now. Like, it's all about the American dream and making it big, and everything that you're ever fed is either, you know, the potential for you to be something and that, like,
you know, entitled to become something. And then at the same time, all of the media and everything that you're exposed to is constantly people who have reached some level of success and they have nice houses and they are influential and they are people in society. And like, to use a very easy person, like, you know, the Jeff Bezos of the world, where it's like, or the Elon Musks, where it's like,
or look at Cardi B. She was on Instagram as a funny stripper and now she's like,
it. Well, and yeah, Cardi B, I mean, you can look at rap artists. You could even look at like, you know, famous, you know, what's the thing called, TikTok, not to age myself.
The kids.
But like,
Tom is literally 26 years old.
Yeah, seriously. He's younger than me. Yeah. He's like, what's that confounded technology?
My knees hurt too much for the tic-tac.
But I'm not trying to sound like an idiot, but could you imagine? So,
but you are.
If we, well, that's fine. Idiot. But just imagine, like, if we fast forward, you have somebody who, like, right now is, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. And all they're constantly exposed to is the Elon Musks, the Jeff Bezos, you know, the famous TikTok artists, the, you know, influential rappers, the Cardi B's, the Drakes, like, you know, all these people that all they do is show off everything that they have and how much that they've become. And you're also being constantly fed on the other side, how like everything is at your disposal and you have all this. And then you go through a mediocre life where, or say a mediocre period of life where you're 15, 16, 17, 18 right now, and then you just have a normal college, you know, experience, and then you get a normal 9-to-5 job, and the next thing you know, you wake up and you're 26, 27, 28, making 40, 50 grand a year at a basic desk job, still watching all these people and all of society put in your face how great it is and how life is so amazing. Like, how do you not feel at some level like a failure?
But I have an interesting response to that.
Okay.
So I think what's interesting is, so we've all, like, you know, I think like the American dream or whatever, or the unlimited potential paradigm has been like, everyone kind of agrees that's kind of bunk, right? Even though we're all still fed those media stories and we're all still compelled by them. But what's interesting is you see this more and more with like internet people, like this message that all feelings are valid, that Venmo me because I need help with my apartment, and that's being normalized, like to beg online because you're a black or brown person in a bad way. You know, like, we won't get into the race element, but there is this like pushback against the American dream that's taking, I think, a really distorted form that is basically removing that element of self-responsibility from it, saying like, you know, I am like, you know, I am a mentally ill, jobless person, and my feelings are valid. And it's all of these, like, you know, identifiers as to the reasons why you're not succeeding and how those reasons are writ large valid. And we all have to accept that, when it's like mental illness, like, plot twist, I don't think that's fucking valid. Like, fix yourself. You have to be pretty fucked up in order for that to like not be work onable. Just saying, like, as someone with a mental fucking illness, like, so there's this pushback against the American dream that I think is distorted in our modern, like, literal moment, like where we are right now. That right. is really interesting and also deeply depressing.
Right, there's a conception that
Alex is going to cut some of that shit that I said.
those that you know, do end up getting the, you know, middle class level jobs, right, are you know, culpable or somehow responsible enough to be able to have to support people who can't.
Or who won't. Or I who think won't. That's important.
But I think the main point is I, you know, like, whatever.
Do you know what I was saying? Can you try to say what I was saying smarter? Because you always do that.
Well, I would just say that you're...
And I like what you're saying.
That you're saying the flip side of, like, how people are responding to the end of the American dream, per se, is that they are then saying, well, if I can't have a part of it, then I deserve, you know, like, it, you know, it's not...
Then it's not a failure. It's not right. That the American dream is wrong. It's that the problems with me are not problems.
Right, or they're not problems, or that they're, you know, they're forgivable, and that's the reason why I can't have it is because of these, like,
or that the obstacles to your success are therefore your identity, and all identities are valid.
Right.
The identification of circumstance,
right,
is a fucking scourge. Like,
so I think I
get it together.
Well, I mean, it depends on the circumstance, right? You know, like, nobody's going to get this bread to somebody in fucking Darfur.
No, but
right?
but then it's going to be, like, become more than your circumstance.
Well, I'm saying that's not always possible. The point.
But the conception of yourself can be.
Well, sure.
You
I
can
mean,
be
people
poor,
can
but
hustle.
You can be funny. You can be poor as shit, have one leg, but be hilarious. And you can either say, I'm a poor one-legged bitch, or you can say, I'm fucking funny, though. It's the conception of the self based on those limitations, and having those that self-conception based on limitation validated over and over and over again, replacing the self, I find dangerous and weird, much the way that I find the lie of the American dream dangerous and weird when it comes to how people live their lives, make their choices, and assess failure or success based on those circumstances.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
I know you do.
I'm not disagreeing with you. All I'm saying is that there are varying kinds of circumstances, and some of them I'm more sympathetic to than others.
Sure.
And I think it's, but the main point I wanted to make was that we live in Rome. We are Rome.
Oh, shit, and the aqueducts are filled with lead.
We are the center of economic power, in that if you don't have, like, if you are a person who doesn't have children, doesn't have a debilitating mental or physical disability, is decently bright, and is willing to work, you will be able to make a decent amount of money.
Yeah.
Into your, like, mid-20s and 30s. It's kind of impossible not to do. Like, if you add all those things together, you're not going to become Jeff Bezos. You're not going to be able to, like, you know, make millions and millions of dollars, but you'll be able to live comfortably. The issue comes is when you don't have any of those things. You know, if you're, you know, a kid and you get a girl pregnant at 16, that's going to hamper your shit. Unless you have that sort of, like, you know, whatever, that dig deep kind of mentality.
Or, like, a super cool mom.
Or, yeah, super cool mom. Or, like, you know, a good support structure. You know, if you have, you know, if you got... And it's possible to overcome any of these obstacles. It's just harder. But
you literally have, like, the competition is a leg up on you, if you will.
Right. And so, you know, but I do think that the, like, it's not like everybody can have that, because those are qualifiers and there are gates to get through in order to get there. Right. But it, you know, for people like us, right, like, it is entirely possible to get middle class wages for now. You know, who the fuck knows what happens in the future. But
you make, like, $4 billion a month.
I make a good amount of money.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm in a good situation. And, you know, it was a rough road to get there, but I did eventually get there. But, you know, I think that the response to the American dream and its, is, you know, it's the traditional response of kind of like, it's passivity, right? So you're not saying that, like, okay, you know, we're being told we can get the American dream, but that's not true. And therefore, we should, you know, maybe fight for a world in which everybody has the opportunity to get the American dream, right? You're asking, can I be given sort of like the C-grade version of the American dream, right?
No, I think what I'm pointing to is that for the longest time, we assigned value to your successes, materially evidenced, so whether that's through money or, you know, fame or these things that you can kind of put a pin on, right?
Sure.
For the longest time, we assign social and self value through those things. And then over time, we realize, well, wait a second, not everybody can get that. So therefore, making self worth about that might not be it, right? So then we see this flip side where self worth is now twisted into all worth, all self is worthy, right? So the things about yourself, such as your mental illness or your poverty or these things that should, that normally and have previously been, you know, obstacles to overcome or circumstances through which that you have to navigate, become the identity, become the way in which you value or assign worth to yourself. It is the, like, the value system. The pushback against the myth of the American dream is corrupting a lot of people's self-value systems in a way that I think is ultimately, like, destructive to society at large, and can lead to, like, speaking of suicide. Like, are we going to normalize giving up on that? Are we going to say it's okay? Are we going to say people should be allowed to kill themselves?
Wait, I think you should be allowed, but I think it's shameful. Can I clarify what you're saying? So,
I don't know. I'm riffing. There's some interesting stuff in the mix there. Because
you keep pushing back every time I say something, so it makes me feel like I'm not understanding what you're saying. So
that could very well be true. I also might not know what I'm saying. I've had most of a Smirnoff Ice.
Yeah, which is, like, a lot for her. But so you're saying that...
Because of my disability.
That, you know, the the center of an individual's value used to be determined by, you know, merely the material possessions that you could showcase, right? Nice car, nice house, yada, yada. The pushback...
Not merely,
against
but
it,
largely.
Largely, yeah. But the pushback to it is saying that, like, okay, well, it's not the things that make me valuable, but it's me that makes me valuable.
Yes.
Right? It's what I am, not what I could be,
And not what I do either.
Not what I do, but
which
what
I think
am.
Is what, which I think is what self-value should come from, right? It is not that I am valuable because I am a woman, because I am a rape survivor. Like, I'm trying to think what would be in my lefty Twitter bio, right? Because I am a rape survivor, because I have had an abortion, you know, I was right. a terminated mother, like these things that like these people like proudly fucking proclaim, right? That is not what gives me value. Self-worth cannot be the material results of succeeding in the American dream, because that's bunk, right? Or it's not necessarily true. And it can't be the like self-effizing of your circumstance to define yourself by that isn't right either. So,
well, I think it's just more, I don't know if I have like a hard opinion on what, you know, what the American dream should be, quote unquote. But like, I do think that, you know, we should be searching for a new way, right? What would it mean, right, for the whole of society to be able to, you know, self-actualize in a way that doesn't result in Akutagawa's fate, right?
Ooh,
where Akutagawa could live in a world where that motherfucker could live in a world and he could just write all the goddamn short stories he want well into his old age and not feel like it was all worth nothing, you know?
How do we make passion for passion's sake worthy, like socially and
he could still hate all the motherfuckers who call him sensei. There's nothing that precludes that, right? Why did he get so fucking quiet?
Because Troy is just fucking quitting.
Troy's falling asleep.
Troy's committing podcast suicide.
No, but there was like some background noise. I think it might have been
air conditioning.
AC.
Yeah.
AC or but the main...
In
just
our,
saying,
in our
like,
fine studio.
Akutagawa could totally, you know, he could diss the shit out of his fucking, you know, his weeb ass motherfucking, whatever, otaku fans.
Leave that part in, Alex.
But he, you know, he could still be generally satisfied with his life that, you know, all of the little, you know, because he, I don't know, he strikes me as a guy who's like, you know, I don't, collects toy figurines, you know.
Could he be, though,
he's like
in
a,
Japan?
He's can like a be... coin collector.
Question. Could, is it possible for, would it actually be possible for him to be self-satisfied if other people weren't in Japan at that time?
Well, but if you're talking about the specific time period and the specific situation, then it's a lot more difficult. But I think what Sam's alluding to is, you know, there's no reason that a situation like that shouldn't exist. And it's also not, it's not isolated to Japan at that time. I mean,
right,
the shit that he went through and where his mental state mm-hmm. was at that led him to suicide is not that far different from a lot of things that happen in the United States today.
Or so, at that time.
So the question becomes, like, why? And especially, you know, if you think about Japan at that time, there is a huge opportunity there. I mean, look at how far Japan came in such a short period of time. You think we did it quickly. Like, Japan went from feudal society in 1867 to where they're at today in 2020. You
right.
know, you're talking 140-some-odd years. And
the world has transformed,
and
yeah.
You can even... That's actually, like, making it sound... faster than it actually was. I mean, they were pretty much on par, technologically speaking, with us by like 1970, 1980, and the things that they were producing and the things that they mm-hmm. were capable of doing. So that's within a 100-year period of time. So
within, you know, like somebody could theoretically have been born and watched the whole thing happen.
Correct.
Probably did.
And so, you know, you're talking about something that happened to somebody in a period of time that there is so much opportunity and so much potential, you know, taking out some things like class structure.
Or like World War II.
Well, World War II is a small hiccup. It's
yeah,
not,
you know,
it's not like it changed the course of history.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
none
yeah.
of that stuff happened. It was just a minor scuffle between countries.
Well, no. I want Tom to finish his fucking thought.
No. It just is interesting to me. And, you know, in a certain respect, I can sympathize with it. Although it's, I think there's just a lot of external things that play into why somebody's frame of mind gets to that point. And it's because you're constantly exposed with all these success stories and all this, you know, idea of opportunity. And when you watch other people pass you by and you watch the years go by and you're not up to that standard, you can still live a perfectly fine life. But I just, you know, think about... like the example I was giving earlier, you know, somebody who's, you know, in their teenage years going through high school right now, watching all these like influencers and the Elon Musks and the professional athletes.
No, just looking at their friends who have the right Instagram accounts and TikTok accounts.
And not even, say they don't even know these people personally, but say they get into like their mid-20s, late-20s, early-30s, and they live perfectly fine lives.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, take their circumstances and just make them like as mediocre as you could think. Like, they don't grow up in Compton. They don't grow up in Harlem. They have economic opportunity. They get an education. They get a perfectly normal 9-to-5 job in an office, you know, making 50, 60 grand a year. They get married. They have a couple kids. They have a modest house. And like, if you took their situation in a bubble, you'd be like, well, what's wrong with that? Like, that's perfectly okay. But they've been, you know, shoved down their throat for so long how great things can be and how far society progress. And they watch, like, you never think about, how often do you think about the peers you went to school with that like failed and like burned out and like, you know, got arrested and went to jail? And then you have the other ones that were successful and that you compare yourself to and that, you know, you wish you made the money that they made or had the job situation that they had. And then you see the extremely successful people, you know, every once in a while, you know, somebody that like hit it big and like they got the right stock options or they got into the right company. And when you, when you're told this and when you see this perspective of life for so long, you can live a perfectly okay life, but your brain tells you that you're steps behind, you're too far behind, you didn't make it. Like, these people have a life that you'll never live, and it becomes what could be a positive if you looked at it. Your brain is wired to look at it as a negative.
Yeah, so I definitely, like, so I agree with you that that is a cause of much, like, distress, right? Amongst those who view themselves as socially mobile, you know, especially young people who are looking, you know, to make a mark on the world in whatever way they want to. I would just say that what bring, and, you know, obviously suicide's complicated and people kill themselves for a variety of reasons, but I would say that the mover of suicide is like when you go from that moment to a moment of hopelessness, right?
Right.
When you go from a moment not of ascendancy, right, necessarily, because people who are like power hungry and who are willing to do anything to like get the thing they want, they don't really give a shit about failing, right? Because they're just going to get up and do the fucking thing again because they're going to, they want it. You know, I mean, that's just their personality. I'm not that kind of person, but there are people out there who are like that. But people who are aspiring to, you know, live a certain kind of lifestyle, to be respected in their local community, to, you know, when people come over and ask them what they do, they can be proud of what they say they do, those kinds of things. When they are then, when that is taken away from them and there's no way to get it back, right? That's, that is the like moment, right? Where it's complete desperation. You know, you can't say I'm an auto worker anymore. You're just a bum. You're a bum who's addicted to drugs.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't send your kid to college anymore. Your youngest kid, right? You send everybody else to college, but you can't send the other kid to college anymore. Right. Because it's too expensive and you don't have a fucking job anymore. And the company sold out to whatever and didn't, you know, and canceled on your pension. And you're waiting for the class action lawsuit against the conglomerate or whatever.
Right.
So I think that it's like the, it's the despair of having once have that, but with artistic sensibilities like Akutagawa, right? Like, it's more of just like not grasping that there is like, what's the point in this, right? It all feels so arbitrary and mean to all of the modernization that Japan is doing, right? Like, sure, maybe it's good for the nation or it's good for some people, right? But it's not good for him, and it doesn't imbue his life with any meaning because he's a writer, you know? He gets meaning from, it's like from life itself,
right?
And he doesn't see any meaning in the way people live.
No, and he had an exceptionally bleak outlook on things. I mean, he had, you know, almost no sense of, you know, emotion or feeling. Like, you know, in some of the stuff that I read, he surprised himself when he had an emotional reaction to something. You know, the world was a dark, dark place for this person, regardless of his job or his economic situation, of his family.
He just had a dark cloud, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I don't know. For me, it's like if I'm in a bad headspace and I'm, you know, not feeling super confident about myself, I still, like, have things in my life that I can look at and be like, well, but I want to do that. Like, you know, for me, lamely, it's like golfing. Like,
my man loves to golf.
Or like golfing or reading. Like, reading a good book is another thing for me. Even just like having a couple drinks with like friends is another thing. Like, you know, things in my job or in like my marriage or in my economic situation cannot be going well, and I can be upset and like depressed about that, but I can, there's still other things in life that like I have a certain level of like enjoyment and value and emotional attachment to that I'm not at a point ever that I'm like, well, none of this is worth it, like this isn't like anything. But I also have a lot of economic upside. I have a lot of road ahead of me, where somebody, like you were saying, from like the Rust Belt, they could have had like an up and coming career, a good life going on. You know, they had the world ahead of them. They had all these plans for like, you know, their house and their kids' education, everything else. And that gets ripped out from underneath them. And now they're too old to catch up with things. And they're left in a place of desolation. And like, maybe golfing's not enough for them, because I have a lot more auxiliary things that have upside.
Right.
And then there also is that physiological element too, though. Like, we don't know what this dude's brain was like.
Right, the physiological element.
I don't think chronic pain, he's
drinking whiskey for
no,
a
but
reason.
I mean, he had
a lot of physical pain.
I even mean the neurochemical element of like mental illness and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
Or depression. Like
CTE.
We don't know what the fuck his brain was doing.
Yeah, we really don't.
He could have been goofed up or just not juicing up the right kind of shit.
He could have had smooth spots in his frontal cortex, you know?
Yeah, like, what's his brain pan looking like, you know?
Okay, so on the brain pan thing, right. I apparently have to go fucking work again. God damn it.
Yeah, Troy's been snoozing for the past, like, hour.
Troy's been wanting to go to sleep.
Are you safe to drive home?
Next week, we're going to read the first part of Snow Country.
Oh, nice.
Is that the book we're on? Okay, Troy's nodding, so I think that's right. So we're going to read the first part of Snow Country.
You're doing a silent podcasting bit,
we'll decide on the fucking, you know, like, the page number.
How
whatever.
Snowy is it?
We read books so you don't fucking have to. So you don't have to worry about that shit, you dumb bitches.
See you next week.
It's me. I'm dumb bitches.
You illiterate fucks.
Thank
Goodbye,
you
friends.
For listening. And we'll see you next time. Good night.
Bye.
Good night,
everyone.